from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. The political train wreck in Washington has Democrats salivating for the 2018 congressional elections, hoping to win back the House, and that road runs straight through California. But Democrats here have plenty of their own problems, a kind of civil war between supporters of Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, and the lack of a message that resonates beyond the coasts and cities. This hour, the path forward for Democrats as they hope to take advantage of Republican disarray. We'll get started right after this news. Good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. Well, election night 2016 was a grim one for Democrats across the nation. Donald Trump, of course, shocked Hillary Clinton, leaving Republicans in charge of the White House and Congress. And while things haven't quite turned out the way Republicans hoped or Democrats feared, Democrats are in many ways in disarray themselves, fighting over party leadership nationally and here in Washington, in California. And there are still some big questions, like should the party move further left toward the Bernie Sanders wing of the party or to the middle to win over rural and suburban voters? And to chew that over this hour, we have a very shy and reserved panel, starting with Katie Merrill, who is a partner in, Bauman Merrill, California-based political consulting firm. Marisa Lagos, who's with KQED's California Politics and Government Desk.
Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Marisa. And Christine Pelosi, chair of the California Democratic Party Women's Caucus. Christine, good to have you here.
Thank you.
You know, winning tends to paper over differences sometimes, and losing highlights them and exposes them. And I think that the party is now going through that process of examining what happened in 2016. And I'm wondering, I'll start with you, Katie, does the party have a problem or problems? And if so, what are they?
Well, the main problem that the Democratic Party has nationally is that we have no power. We don't have the White House, we don't have the House of Representatives, and we don't have the U.S. Senate. So that's the problem that we're tackling right now, and we have to figure out how to get power back. In the first place that we're focusing is winning the House back in 2018.
But did you get to that place because the party had a different problem or set of problems?
No, I think that we're in a situation now where the House of Representatives has been essentially gerrymandered in every state, so the Republicans have a structural advantage in those elections. And in terms of the White House and what happened in 2016, I think that there were a combination of issues that and I think people are still looking at what exactly happened. But it was as much about turnout and as much about enthusiasm, and we can get into this, but also about a sector of the electorate nationally that had essentially sat out 2012 and came back with a roar in 2016.
And the reverse is true. There were people that came out in 2012 for Barack Obama who didn't come out.
That's correct. That is correct.
Yeah. And so, Christine Pelosi, what would you add to that? And, what Katie was describing there, the lack of and the redistricting, the gerrymandering, part of that is that Republicans are in complete control in a lot of states with governorships. I think Democrats have just 15 governorships. I mean, that, too, is indicative of a message problem?
Well, I think America has a problem. It's a white supremacy problem. You saw it boil over in the tragic murder in Charlottesville over the weekend and the death of the two state troopers. But the fact of the matter is that if you look at Citizens United and the wave that it brought in of
corporate
money.
That's the Supreme Court decision regarding campaign funding.
Right. That basically said all bets are off. Corporations are people and they can give in endless amounts of dark money that came in, swamped the Democrats across the board in 2010. And then when Republican governors and Congress took over, they built in white supremacy into their voter suppression tactics. And so if you look at what's been happening, both their long-held ultra-conservative opposition to a government role in public policy and voting rights for African Americans and anything to do with Barack Obama, you had a dangerous trifecta. That's been the challenge. Democrats did win the popular vote in 2016, but were gerrymandered, as Katie said, out of electoral success. We actually won seats in the House, but didn't win enough because of gerrymandering. But one thing that's also changed since 2016 is the outpouring of millions of people in the streets monthly since the Women's March. So they may have the presidency and the Congress and the Supreme Court after stealing a seat from Barack Obama and Merrick Garland, but we have the people. And the question for Democrats is whether we can answer a call to service to bring those people together to advance a vision using clean money to do it that will lead to Democrats being back in power.
And Marisa, there are also, of course, divisions within the party. And I wonder if you could just sort of quickly bring everybody up to speed on what happened in the past several months with the fight over the chair position with the Democratic Party in California.
Well, right. I mean, and I think some of the divisions within California, which are natural in any political party. I mean, I was reflecting during your intro that in some ways you could say the same thing about Republicans, just that they did win and they're still fighting, right? But I think it's fascinating that we're seeing the same divisions play out within California, given the very strong control Democrats do have here. So it's almost, it's similar to what's happening nationally. But essentially what you're referring to is this fight over the party chair. Longtime politician and party chair leader John Burton stepped down in, was that June? Gosh, It seems so long ago now. And it turned into a very contentious fight between Eric Bauman, who had been the vice chair of the party for a while and was sort of the heir apparent, I think, in a lot of people's eyes for a long time.
Consummate party insider.
Yeah. And Kimberly Ellis, who came from outside, and she had run Emerge, which is a group that encourages Democratic women to run for office. African-American woman from the East Bay of San Francisco, Eric Bauman's from L.A. And it kind of turned into a similar, I would say, battle as we saw at the DNC last year with, you know, a lot of the left wing of the party supporting Kimberly Ellis and seeing her as an outsider that could move the party in a more progressive into a more progressive place. And Eric Bauman is the insider. I mean, ironically, Bauman is not exactly like a super moderate Democrat. He also, in a lot of ways, comes from the progressive ring.
It's the nature of the Democratic Party in California that he's regarded as the moderate.
It is. And, you know, and I will also note, like, you talked about moving towards the Bernie wing. I mean, Bernie's not a Democrat. I think we should all mention that when we talk about this. He's still an independent, which I think is really interesting. But, you know, a lot of his followers clearly feel that on a number of issues that the party has sort of given ceded power to sort of a more corporate model, that, you know, they want to see single payer. They want to see more progressive policies, not just adopted as part of the party platform, but really brought into legislation and that. So Kimberly Ellis, I mean, this was a 1% win basically by Bauman, and Ellis has so far refused to concede. There's been recounts, there's been audits, and it is continuing, I would say, to splinter the Democratic, at least the party faithful in California.
And Christine, I don't want to wade too deeply into that, but I believe you supported Kimberly Ellis.
I did. I supported Kimberly Ellis, and also as the chair of the California Democratic Party Women's Caucus, I supported Carolyn Fowler for secretary. Both women have undergone a ballot review, as is their right under the bylaws. I had some good conversations with Kimberly at Netroots Nation last weekend in Atlanta.
Do you think she should drop it and just kind of let the party move on?
I think that what Kimberly should do, and what I talked to her about quite extensively, is what she's going to do, which is propose a series of reforms for the party that fall into certain buckets. One is overall election reform. Everybody would agree that we could do better, and that our bylaws need to establish a more clear elections process. It wasn't really designed that there would be a 1% election.
Yeah,
as
I mean,
Lisa called it.
He won by what, 60-something votes?
Right. So out of 3,000 cast.
Yeah.
So that's number one, just in terms of some election reforms. The second is to move the party in a more progressive direction. The third is to have some bylaws changes that accommodate the grassroots elements of the party more so than the elected officials. And the fourth are really come down to the way that the party is candid and transparent about our budgeting. I would just say one thing. In the 1970s, when I was a little kid and my mom was just getting involved in the California Democratic Party, she was a Jerry Brown person. So they were the ones shaking up the party. Right. By the time I was chairing the platform committee, it was Howard Dean and Dennis Kucinich people coming in terms of Democracy for America and Progressive Democrats of America. So then the Obama folks came in. They were the only anti-establishment people to win, by the way. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, now you have the Bernie folks. So there's always a responsibility, I think, for those of us who are establishment Democrats to make room for the new people. I would also say that in the 1970s, our own Leo McCarthy, when he was the assembly speaker, moved to curtail the power of the legislature and the party and added the county committees. When mm-hmm. I was executive director, the very first thing I did in 1988, in the summer of 88, as party executive director, was to actually go to the legislature and ask them to change the law that said when the convention was being held, because it was supposed to be held on inauguration weekend. This is before George Bush used Willie Horton and that white supremacy back then to have us lose the election. But the very fact that we had to go to the legislature to ask when we could change our convention showed you how much control they had. We added assembly district committees in 1989, and now there's another move to add even more grassroots power. So the leverage has always been slowly shifting from the legislature to the grassroots, and I think Kimberly Ellis's campaign is offering a continuation of that shift, and I think there's a lot of Bauman supporters who would agree on some of those changes.
I want to move it toward a little bit toward message, this conversation. I know, Katie, you have been working in places like Modesto and this sort of the Central Valley down through Southern California, seven congressional districts that Democrats are targeting. If they want to retake the House, they've got to win some of those seats.
Right.
What are you hearing from voters? I know you've been spending time in Jeff Denham's district, for starters. What are you hearing from voters who perhaps voted for Hillary Clinton, but also voted for Jeff Denham, the Republican congressman there, or just in general, what are their feelings about the party?
Well, to your point, there are these seven congressional districts in California that were won by Hillary Clinton but reelected Republican members of Congress. And so there are 24 districts across the country that we need to win in order to take back the House. Seven of them are here. This is really where donors in California, activists in California, should be focusing their attention on these seven districts because they're winnable. What's interesting about what we've found in our research is that voters, not surprisingly, I mean, it's pretty intuitive, they care about local issues. They are, especially these ticket splitters and persuadables, they are disengaged. They're occasional voters. They're disillusioned and they're disaffected. They don't have fond feelings about either party. They do not have fond feelings about elected officials. They think that what happens in Washington affects their daily lives, but they also feel like they have no power whatsoever to affect change in Washington. So there's a lot of frustration there. And what they care about is what they're talking to their families about around the kitchen table. So it's not Russia and it's not Trump. It is things like in the Central Valley, water, jobs, in many cases, crime. And in the more urban parts of the Central Valley, homelessness.
Yeah. Let's pick one issue, immigration. And, you know, the Republicans and Trump have used that issue, focusing on things like the tragedy that happened at Pier 7, I think it was, in San Francisco, the Kate Steinle murder. And they've used that to drive a wedge in some ways by frightening people, I think is fair to say. But there is also, and I'm wondering if you encounter this, Katie, and anyone jump in, but folks who feel that the Democratic Party in the last few years has shifted its attention and its concern and its message too far toward, say, undocumented immigrants. You know, when you've got other people struggling to make ends meet who are here legally, immigrants or otherwise. What are you hearing about that? What do you think about that?
Well, when you ask folks, and particularly in the Central Valley, do you think there should be a path to citizenship for folks who are here that are undocumented, and particularly farm workers, it's an overwhelmingly positive yes response. A lot of that has to do with the fact that the Central Valley economy hinges on agriculture. So we are the breadbasket for the world. It is when you put things in a partisan frame that the voters start to check out. And if they don't check out, they get angry. They don't like the fighting between the Democrats and the Republicans. They don't like the fighting and the gridlock between the White House and Congress. And so if you put any issue, including immigration, into a partisan frame, that's where they want nothing to do with the discussion.
Marisa?
Yeah, and I also think this speaks to how different, you know, the landscape is in California on a lot of issues, right? I think that we do have rural areas of the state that may, you know, have similarities with some of the battleground states the Democrats lost in 2016. But overall, you know, it is a very different landscape here. And I mean, I think you hear this not just in the way Democrats talk about things, but Republicans. I mean, when we talk about immigration and the debate over, you know, becoming a so-called sanctuary state, the rhetoric in Sacramento from Republicans in the legislature is very different than what you're hearing in D.C., especially from Trump, but even from Republicans there. You know, I think that there is a sense that a lot of these folks are their constituents and that this is a real melting pot. We had Kevin Faulkner, the mayor of San Diego San Francisco this week, talking about NAFTA and how important free trade is for an open border for a city like San Diego. So I think just as we have this discussion, it is important to differentiate a little bit between what's happening in California and what the Democrats need to do on a national scale, because it's different. And every election is won on a local level.
But
right?
Even here, and anyone, again, jump in on this, you look at Ami Bera, who is a, I think, in his third term in Congress, Sacramento area Democrat, barely wins. He's always won by very, very narrow margins against the Republican. Now you've got a liberal, sort of a Bernie Sanders Democrat jumping into the primary against him or into the, you know, in the June election next year. We don't know what's going to happen there. But is that, Christine Pelosi, the kind of thing that indicates sort of the health of the party, or is it a warning for the party?
Well, first, on the issue of immigration, I think that it's fair to say that Republicans in California speak differently because they saw what happened when they spoke the way Donald Trump speaks. Pete Wilson did it first. On the last day of his governorship, we had bumper stickers that said, Adios, Pete Wilson, Proposition 187, which was passed by the voters, by the way, that included Democrats, which denied services to undocumented Californians, was something that California had to atone for. And Democrats atoned first and Republicans doubled down. And that's why they lost. And that's why they don't have very serious candidates for statewide office. And they won't until they improve their language, with the exception of Party of One, Arnold Schwarzenegger, that is. So the fact of the matter is, when you look at immigration, we're also looking at our own multi-status families. We're looking at, you know, my daughter's in public schools. One out of every eight children in the San Francisco Unified Public School District has an undocumented parent. This time, for the first time in a long time, really since the Pete Wilson days, at back to school night in San Francisco, and I imagine across the country, you're going to have families having to decide which non-deportable relative is going to go to back to school night to support the child. That's something that is fundamental. So that makes the discussion about immigration also have to revolve around families, education, and healthcare. And I think because we had the bad experience in California, we are more quickly able to have a more cohesive conversation about that. And it also means that when you try to divide people and say, oh, that's just identity politics. No, civil rights is bigger than that. And families who of multi-status families are really, I think, looking at the parties and saying, who's on my side supporting me and who's telling me that my family members have to go?
But Katie, there was, and I want to come back to Ami Bera, but either that message wasn't getting through or it didn't resonate with a lot of voters, not in California, not in San Francisco, but in Ohio and Pennsylvania, Michigan, and maybe even African-American voters. I don't know what the data show on that.
But. Well, there is actually very interesting data about what happened in the 2016 election, particularly with the white working class vote. And essentially what it shows is that, I mean, the Democrats have always had trouble with that sector of the electorate nationally and in presidential elections. So in 2008, when President Obama was elected, that portion of the electorate was extremely disillusioned because it was their kids that were going to war and fought these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and they felt that they were ignored at best. And they were the ones that were the hardest hit, this sector of the electorate, by the foreclosure crisis and by the fraudulent and illegal activities of Wall Street that
no one
impacted
was really punished
them.
For.
Right. And so in 2012, 4 years later, they felt like no one was punished for these things. No one's listening to us. We are the hardest hit, and no one's paying attention. We're sitting this election out.
Well, and then you compound that, just, and I'll let you get in, Marisa, but, you know, with Hillary Clinton taking, what was it, $680,000 for a speech to Goldman Sachs, you know, it kind of underscores their concern or their, you know,
but also apathy. But also by 2016, and I think more relevant is that, you know, the unemployment rate was moving back down towards 5% and 4%, but not for them.
Right.
And they were in worse shape than ever. They had lost their job. They were now working 3 jobs to try and replace the job they lost in 2008. They weren't back in their homes. And here comes a candidate, Donald Trump, who was talking to them and seeing them. And that made them stand up and come out and vote in ways that they had not 4 years before.
Yeah, and I think that speaks to, I mean, Katie kind of hit on this in her opening comments, but so there was issues, I believe, yeah, with that messaging and the fact that if you do feel left behind and you maybe have some, you know, uncomfortableness, especially I would say older working class voters, with the direction the country is headed and that the, you know, changes in our demographics, and you have a candidate that can tap into some of those, you know, those fears, that was successful. And then you also saw, as Katie sort of alluded to earlier, that you didn't have a candidate in Hillary Clinton that who was maybe, you know, really inspiring some folks who maybe were on the fence in past years, maybe African-American voters, to come out and vote. And so it is sort of a confluence of events, I would say, in that way that you see, you know, the landscape change nationally. And I do think that when it comes to messaging, that is something, you know, that's going to be a continuing discussion. I think there are people on the right that are never going to vote Democratic. And a lot of them are the ones who I think when we talk about identity politics are really, really turned off. But there, I do think that there's a middle ground there, because the Democrats can't just turn around and leave behind the coalition that is their base, right? You can't say we're not going to talk about women or LGBT rights or all, you know, or immigrants.
Well, underlying a lot
But wait, Scott, I think we just have to get to the data here, because the data was clear on 2 points. First of all, in the 3 swing states that Hillary Clinton lost by less than 80,000 votes. I mean, let's be clear. As you said in the beginning, we'd have a different conversation 80,000 votes out of tens of millions. So let's be clear about that, number one. Number two, there was a report that NBC News put out June 20th, 2016. It's called The United States of Trump. It looked at where Donald Trump did well early, where many of us predicted. In fact, I was sneered at on national television in July of 2015 for saying that Trump could win because I saw that he had something: the celebrity infotainment culture, the money, and the connection with people. Now, here's the thing. There were 3 factors. The first factor was wage stagnation between 2004 and 2014. Number two, jobs lost to globalization or automation. And number three, white distress in the workplace. That is to say, combination of 2 factors. There was a lower participation of white males in the workplace, and they were distressed about it. And that, going to what Marisa was just saying, is people whose story was, we've been waiting in line, and all of a sudden, all these other people are cutting in line. And rather than blaming the person that didn't give them a raise or didn't train them for a new job, they were blaming Barack Obama and women and people of color. Their story was, Christine Pelosi cost me my promotion. If only she wasn't in the workplace, I'd be a manager by now.
All right. That is Christine Pelosi talking, along with Marisa Lagos and Katie Merrill. We're going to continue our conversation about the path forward for the Democratic Party. What's gone wrong? What do they need to do going forward to win back the House? And many other issues related to the party. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Please join us. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. 866-733-6786, or email us. It's forum@kqed.org. And welcome back to Forum. We are talking this hour about the future of the California Democratic Party and the party nationally as well. Our guest, Katie Merrill, partner in Bauman Merrill. She's a California Bay Area-based political consultant. Marisa Lagos, our own reporter here at KQED on KQED's Politics and Government Desk. And Christine Pelosi, chair of the California Democratic Party Women's Caucus. Again, if you want to join us, it's 866-733-6786. I'm going to get to the calls and some listener comments, but I do want to, and we were talking about this during the break a little bit, where you've got races now where a Democrat, either a Democratic incumbent is being challenged by a more liberal Democrat, which is happening up in Sacramento to Ami Berra. And then down in Daryl Issa's district in San Diego, you've got two Democrats running. Again, the question to any of you, is that a sign of the health of the party or is it a problem potentially?
I see it as a sign of the health of the party. Primaries are the place where voters decide, where you discuss these ideas, you discuss what the party's about, and voters decide. And Democratic voters get to decide who they want to be their nominee. Even in our top two primary process, it's essentially the same dynamic as if it were a closed primary. So one, I think that's what primaries are for, and so I think it's a good thing. The second thing is, you know, we have seen an unprecedented amount or number of candidates declaring for these congressional races, and that is
Democrats,
and that is fantastic, and that is a sign of what Christine was talking about earlier, which is this this amazing show of response from Democrats. People in their who in their everyday lives had not been involved in politics before who are saying, I am now getting involved and I am now going to do something. So all of that, I think, is as we continue to look for signs of whether there will be a Democratic wave in 2018 in response to what we're seeing in Washington, I think all signs are very positive for
Marisa?
That. I mean, I think that there is, you know, with Trump especially, a clear delineation between the parties. And obviously not all Republicans would agree with Trump being the face of their party, but he's the president right now, right? And when you look at, I mean, take Trump out of it, though, when you look at the healthcare votes, when you look at the policy that's being debated, you know, I do think that it really has energized folks on the left. And this kind of gets back to the original discussion about the schisms within the party. I mean, people I know who were my age in the Bay Area who had sat out a lot of stuff and I think really felt disillusioned by the Democratic Party are feeling more emboldened to not just get involved, but to push the party in the direction that they want to see it go. And I think that that's a good thing. And you need, you know, younger activists to be there and to be doing that. I think the question is, again, like, what does that look like? Who ends up actually being the candidates? And how does the party respond? I mean, to Christine's earlier point about the legislature controlling things, I mean, the Democratic Party itself still directs a lot of the money in these races. And, you know, I think there's a lot of debates happening also both nationally and within California about, like, what does it mean to be a Democrat? Like, you cannot run the same Democrat in Fresno as you can in San Francisco. This whole question of litmus tests over abortion and those things. So,
You could say the same thing about Sacramento area and Ami Berra, a very purple
absolutely.
District.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that that's something both parties really always have to deal with. But I do feel it's a little more pronounced right now.
But I also want to say, if I could just jump in really quickly, which is, you know who's more unpopular than Trump with the voters in every single district?
Congress.
Yeah.
And who runs Congress? The Republican leadership. So, you know, Trump.
Although that was true when Obama was president.
But it is still true now. and so that is very important when you're talking about these seven congressional districts where we have to. Where we have to win if we're going to win back the House.
Yeah, but also, I would say two things. First of all, every woman in my life has become, since January, a more fierce, distilled essence of herself. Many of the men, too. But when I look at my women's caucus and the resurgence there, you know, people who didn't phone bank are speed dialing senators. People who said, oh, I don't march, are suddenly in the streets monthly. People who would never even run for delegate are now saying they want to run for office. So I think that there is this large awakening. I also think, and I will say this on the abortion issue, my caucus bylaws, if you went to cadem.org and look up the caucuses, you'll see me, my contact info, you'll see our bylaws. We are pro-choice, and our goal is to elect female and feminist candidates. That said, I have pro-life members of my caucus. They don't just fall in there. They pay dues to get there. They communicate with me. They understand the difference between being personally pro-life and saying that the government will not fund or direct a choice which restricts women. The government will not force somebody into carrying forth a pregnancy that she has decided she does not want. So that's where they draw the line, which is personal views. Absolutely. We respect everybody.
Okay, right?
We're a big open tent. And governmentally, where do we want to go? So I'm just telling you where my women are. And they're very strong in how they feel about that. So that's why I think where it's not just that everyone's running. Primaries are good. It's also how you win and how gracious the winner is in including those other candidates. There's like seven people running to replace Jeff Denham.
That's right.
One of them's going to be the nominee. How that nominee is a good winner will determine whether that nominee is the next member of Congress.
All right. Let's go to the phones now. It's Doug in San Leandro. You're first.
Yes. I'm a delegate to the California Democratic Party. I was at the convention. I am from the East Bay, so, you know, the delegates that were elected out of my assembly district are, you know, amongst the people who are agitating to make sure that the Democratic Party gets pushed to the left. That's what I want. I want that to happen. My experience.
What does that mean? What does that mean to you?
So here would be a primary thing that we're talking about. The primary issue that people were talking about at the convention, aside from, you know, people that were agitating for Ellis to win the chair, was single-payer. Single-payer health care was by far the primary issue that people were agitating at. The really, I think, destructive and discouraging thing that's happening within people in the movement who are trying to push the party to the left is that if you are not a supporter, not just of universal coverage of single-payer, you are corrupt.
Well, not only that, we saw. Activists targeting Anthony Rendon, the Speaker
right.
of the Assembly, because he decided not to move that bill forward in the legislature.
That's right. So here's the facts about it, though. The voters of California don't support single payer yet. Not if it makes them pay taxes. It's true. This is the way it's polled. We're working on it. We're getting there. But at the same time that there are activists in my party that are working to try to create a recall for the Speaker of the Assembly, there are right-wing extremists in Orange County who are attempting to recall a state senator who, in a moderate Senate district, has been a really, really solid Democrat. And because of that, right-wing extremists in Orange County are trying to recall him.
Yeah.
They're going to have a vote soon on it.
Not,
and it's really
not as
important
soon as they
that we
want
defend
it.
That. Yeah, we need to defend that Senate.
Yeah, yeah. Marisa, I know you've been down in Orange County covering that. I don't want to go too far into that recall per se. But, you know, this idea of, you know, you're either with us 100% on single payer or you're against us. We've seen Nancy Pelosi and Jackie Speier held a town hall meeting in San Francisco right after the health care bill died in the House, or in the House, I think it was. And everyone in the audience was animated about single payer, yelling at them. And so you've got this kind of, you know, for lack of a better phrase, a civil war going on, or saying you're either with us on this 100% or we're going to be against you.
Yeah. And I mean, I do think that we have to be careful to differentiate between the loudest voices and the majority of voices. I mean, I do think that in general, people on the left end of the spectrum do want to see massive changes to the way we approach healthcare. I mean, actually, everybody probably does. But how that pans out. The fact that this has come up as a sort of, you know, litmus test, as it were, this year, I think has a lot to do with what's happening nationally. And it's interesting. I mean, it's fascinating to me just as an observer that, like, Anthony Rendon is being accused of being this sort of lackey for, like, corporations or whatever, because, you know, he is a fairly progressive member of the Democratic caucus. Now, he's a leader. And part of being a leader, as Nancy Pelosi knows, is that you have to sort of bring in everyone under that big tent. So, again, I think this caller's absolutely right that there are people. And again, I think if you're new to politics, this stuff can be really frustrating because you want to see things change right away. You got involved and you want to push the needle. But I do think that these conversations are happening in a way that Democrats in California on the left have Republicans to thank for making single payer, which, by the way, like Mark Leno in San Francisco has been pushing for a decade. And it really has taken this long to become part of the narrative in sort of the mainstream party in a way that I think these activists want.
But first Christine. Of all, Doug, thank you for your service. Second of all, I chaired the California Democratic Party platform when we put in single payer in 2006. Sheila Kula wrote two bills that Schwarzenegger vetoed. So it has been in the mainstream of the party for a while. We next week are doing a healthcare update at the California Democratic Party Executive Board meeting in Anaheim at our Women's Equality Day celebration. We're going to be in the Women's Caucus highlighting an update on women's health, including the path to single payer in California.
In
so
that,
I think it's important. Let me say this.
Are this
We're supposed to be a laboratory. Well, it's aspirational, but there could be a plan. And we want to discuss the plan. We want to discuss the studies that have been done out of Amherst. You know, the economist, Mr. Pollan, who talks about the value of work and how we could do the pricing. I spoke with Jim Dean about the experiment in Vermont and getting that economist who worked in Vermont to try to talk about California.
Well, let me just stop you, because I feel like we're getting really deep in the weeds. And, you know, back to what Katie was saying, people care about, you know, can they see their doctor? These, you know, I'm not saying, I know that's what you do and that's what happens at the party level. But when, in terms of messaging, you know, that's not what's resonating with people, is it?
Well, what's resonating with people is whether they can count on the health care that they have right now, because every single day that Congress is in session, it has seemed it's been possibly threatened. So they don't know whether the next month they're going to get their subsidy. They don't know whether the next month they're going to be able to have the plan as they have it now. So that's what's on their minds. But, you know, back to this point about whether there's a civil war in the party, I don't think it's a civil war. This is how you – this is how change happens, right? This is how change happens in parties. And then when the change happens in the party, then they try to – you know, then the idea is that change happens in society. So these conversations are ongoing. They're all really productive conversations. You are right, Scott, that folks in Modesto are not necessarily – thinking about whether it's single payer right now. They're figuring out whether they're going to have their health care through Covered California next month.
Let me
but
read
they're
some.
Also thinking about Dottie Nygaard, who's a candidate who supports single payer, who's a nurse running against Denham. So actually, there are hundreds of volunteers in that district who are talking about single payer.
Yes, fair enough.
Trying to have a populist message to the people that you just talked about, saying, hey, here's what we could do. We could cut out the profit margin and get you your health care more cheaply, more directly.
Let's read some listener comments here. Carl tweets, establishment Dems left the party when it embraced Wall Street. Bernie ran as a Democrat. Democrats turned out for him. Forcing Hillary on us was a mistake. I voted for her, but held my nose doing it. Robert writes, why do Democrats insist on the old model fundraising from the wealthiest Americans when we have examples nationally and locally that small dollar fundraising works and encourages participation? The old model is a big reason 90 million people didn't vote in the last election. Any thoughts about that? Because, you know, as someone said, you can't unilaterally disarm. You know, this is the system we have. You know, we don't like it, but we have to play by those rules. But it does turn people off.
Well, I am someone as a person who's running a super PAC right now called Fight Back California. That would be fightbackca.com. to run campaigns in these seven districts, and in particular, their accountability campaigns, so that voters know what these the Republican members are doing when they're voting against their interests. I think that you have to use every arsenal that's available to you. What we commit to is transparency. So what you won't get is dark money. What you won't get is secret contributions that people don't see. You'll see where the money is coming from. But if the Republicans are raising money in unlimited quantities, the Republicans should do – I mean, the Democrats should do that as well. And let's be clear that Republicans run permanent campaigns in these districts. The Congressional Leadership Fund, which is Paul Ryan's super PAC – has already knocked on a million doors in swing districts around the country, and they announced that at the end of June. They have staffers. They are running ads in the California 7 districts. So that's what we're up against, and if we don't use everything that's available to us to win these seats, and knowing that that's what we're running against, then we can't win.
But I think we could if we walked our talk. I tried as a member of the Democratic National Committee. I tried in Atlanta in February at our meeting that elected the new officers to reprise President Obama's ban on corporate PAC money to the DNC. That lost. I'm back with a new resolution that the Unity and Reform Commission is going to look at next week, and the DNC will vote on in October, that says we should walk our talk. Let's ban corporate PAC donations that conflict with our platform. You can run, but let's face it, when Nancy Pelosi was chair of the party, she didn't take tobacco money or nuclear money. You can run as a Democrat and not take money from payday lenders. We can draw some bright lines around the money, the corporate money we're willing to take. There's a whole different world between Ben and Jerry's and your local union print shop giving you a discount and DuPont Chemical writing you a check. And the voters know the difference. And I think if we drew the bright lines, we'd get more Democrats voting.
Let's go to the phones. And Jack in Davis, welcome.
Well, you know, I really think that your voter in the future is going to be the person that you have to look at. That means 15, 16, 17, and 18-year-olds right now. I'm a Bernie Sanders supporter, and I don't think that they're going to go to a $3,000 a plate dinner. And I think that, you know, if you had a $1 hot dog and a $2 hamburger and a few musicians in a park, you're going to attract a lot more Democrats for the party.
Well, and I think what he's talking about is enthusiasm, voter enthusiasm.
Yeah.
You know, if people are excited about a candidate, even if they don't have money, they can put time in, they can give money. I mean, Barack Obama showed that, Bernie Sanders showed that, Howard Dean showed that. None of them won. Well, Barack Obama did it, but voter, he was the only one.
Voter enthusiasm is very interesting, and we've asked this question in our research, and in the particular district that we did some research in, there 70% of Trump voters were very enthusiastic. 55% of Clinton voters were very enthusiastic. So that is devastating for any of us who were 100% behind Hillary Clinton, and for people trying to figure out, even in a district where she won. Now, she won that district by 3 points, and it's a swing district. But the voter there was not nearly the level of enthusiasm that there was among the Trump
base.
Well,
and doesn't that come back to this idea that the field is kind of tilted in favor of the establishment? You know, certainly it was tilted in favor of Hillary in 2008, even though Obama won. But, you know, certainly the Bernie supporters this time around, they felt like we didn't have a chance because of the superdelegates and the money and, you know, the email scandal, all that other stuff. So, you know, that's really underlying a lot of this.
Yeah, I mean, I was just smiling because I was thinking back to one of the last times I saw Christine, which was at the DNC, and the California delegation was probably the loudest sort of Bernie pushback, even though the nomination had been decided at that point. You know, again, I think that there are ways to bring in people, and you know, again, like, what are we talking about here? Are we talking about swing voters who are a very different subset than these? You know, like, Democrats have to find a way, and it's not an easy sort of line to walk, but to keep these party activists excited and happy and feel like they're being heard, but also bring in people that do tend to sort of go in both directions. And I think nationally, one thing it's important to note with, you know, 2016 is that we often see the pendulum swing. When one party has been in control, it is not unusual to see people get fed up with that party and feel like they're not doing enough and kind of go in the other direction. And I think especially being in the Bay Area in California, sometimes that's hard to wrap your head around because things are so blue in a lot of places here. And they're just
pendulum doesn't swing very far.
You don't have those swing voters in the same way. Yeah. But, you know, it is a delicate balance. And, you know, this is why I just talk about it and
let me,
these guys do the work.
No, I think that's exactly right. And I think that what Jack and Davis was telling us is that people will become involved if they think that by that they are welcome. And that's also why we're proposing at the DNC to have a small donor program with more opportunity for the small vote, the small dollar donors to have access to the big decision makers. Because the perception is that if I gave $3, I could go to a picnic in the park, like Jack says. But if I give $3,000, then I can go be in the room where it happens. And the $3 voter should also get to be in the room where it happens.
All right, let's read some comments here. Enrique writes, Obama attributed Hillary's loss to voters choosing the Second Amendment over health care. I don't remember him saying that. But the Democrat platform of infringing on the Second Amendment is a losing issue. Get the National Rifle Association to endorse your candidates and you'll win. Probably not going to happen. although, you know, I do remember after, I think, Sandy Hook, President Obama saying he wasn't going to support any Democrats. And I think he was talking about Heidi Heitkamp from North Dakota, who didn't support gun control. Another litmus test. Should there be litmus tests, you know, for other issues?
Well, let me go back to the research and the data, which is in the Central Valley, in these districts, again, that are, you know, 2 points Democratic registration advantage, maybe up to 10 points registration advantage, districts where the Democratic candidate for president has won over the last couple of cycles. You ask a question, do you think the government will go too far in controlling guns, or do you think the government hasn't gone far enough? And you get a majority, a substantial majority, 58% saying that the government will go too far. Now, why is that? It's not Democrats who think that. It's Republicans and then the growing number of what we call no-party preference voters, independent voters, who, although statewide, tend to vote more Democratic and lean more liberal in these particular districts, lean more conservative. And so the question is, what do you do then? Does that mean that you have to have a Democrat run in order to win that will not support any gun control? No, because that issue, super highly polarized, is not what voters are talking about around the kitchen table.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones, and we go to Santa Rosa. Paul, welcome.
Hi. I just wanted to make the point that Hillary Clinton, I believe, far outspent Trump in the 2016 election and was still beaten. And I wonder whether, you know, the Democrats I'm one, keep saying that, you know, if they get to raise big money, we should be able to raise big money. But I think the truth of the matter is big money is not going to necessarily win you the election. And we've seen that then.
Yeah, and Hillary's not the first candidate to show that. But money is important.
But also so was the over $1 billion in free advertising that Donald Trump got from the mainstream media. And if you look at the polling that they did, the results of data that they did that talked about whether coverage of Hillary Clinton was positive or negative, it was overwhelmingly negative. So we also have to factor in the in-kind contributions that Trump got from the corporate media, his buy substantially outspent hers. But I do agree with the other with the underlying point. We are never going to outspend the Republican Party. Never. As long – it will never happen. And those of us who fought Citizens United, including there were some Democrats and progressives who were for the Citizens United case. Some labor organizations were co-plaintiffs with David Bossie in the Supreme Court case, Citizens United. That
they benefited from it also.
They thought they would benefit. Yeah. Little did they know that the LLCs would all prop up, spring up like weeds and take over and do a chokehold on labor rights. But the fact is you have to have enough to get your message out and be competitive. But it's more important. What does money do? All money does is introduce you to voters and get a conversation going about you. So if you can strategically use your money to get voters to talk about you and have a growing field program, to my mind, knocking on doors is better than just running an ad on television.
All right. Let's go to the phones again. Brian in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. My question is, what is going on with the National Democratic Redistricting Committee? They're supposed to fight gerrymandering and have a 10-year plan to take back Congress. Now, the Republicans executed a 10-year plan and took over the country without being a real majority.
Yeah.
So I support the committee, but nobody knows about it and nobody talks about it. And all I get is email from the committee asking for money.
Yeah. All right, Brian, I'm gonna have Katie answer the question because we're getting short on time.
Is a question about the National Democratic Redistricting Committee, NDRC, newly formed organization this year led by President Obama and Eric Holder. They are doing great work focusing on redistricting at a number of different levels. They're focusing on winning back state legislative seats in 2018, because the state legislatures and the governors control redistricting in most cases. They're focused on governor's races in 2018, because if we win those, Democrats win those, then they are the ones who are helping draw the lines in 2021. They're focusing on even state Supreme Court seats, because some of those are elected and some of those cases, redistricting cases, go to those state Supreme Courts. And they're working on initiatives to try statewide initiatives in certain states, set up nonpartisan redistricting commissions like we have here in California, all of which will be very helpful as we look towards the 2021 redistricting.
All right. Let's go now to Zenaida, who is calling. Welcome.
Hi. I just want to say that it's important to note that the future of the Democratic Party is millennials of color. Or it's important to note that 70% of Latino youth in California in the past primary voted for Bernie Sanders over Hillary Clinton, and that we're seeing a giant energy of millennials of color with Black Lives Matter and other grassroots leftist groups being re-energized. And I think it's crucial that we cater to them first, because that's the future.
Okay, thanks very much. Zenaida, before
thanks,
I let
Zenaida.
You go, who are you excited about these days? You have a candidate you're excited about for any office?
I mean, right now, I don't have a candidate that I'm excited about, much as I'm looking forward to getting 2018 progressive candidates into office.
All right. Well, thanks very much for your work and for calling in. We've got just a few minutes left. We haven't talked much, and I realize it's an eternity away, but 2020, a lot of people are talking about it. The mayor of Los Angeles is
in New Hampshire,
creating a lot of speculation. Kamala Harris is getting a lot of attention and money for her comments and her performance as senator. There are some who think Gavin Newsom will be running for president if he gets elected governor. I've heard that from people in the Democratic Party here in California. Quite apart from picking a horse, what kind of candidate, what kind of person does the party need, do you think?
Well, as Zenaida said, and as the other gentleman who told us to look at the 16-year-olds said, the 16-year-olds who are going to be voting in 2020, the millennials who are going to be working on the campaign around the country, volunteering, parachuting into the suburbs of Los Angeles, known as New Hampshire, as far as Eric is concerned. Let's look to them. Let's talk about what they want. We want a populist message that appeals to people, that calls people to national service, that calls people to local community service, and makes people feel that they're part of something larger than themselves. I would say to you, as the resident establishment Democrat here and a superdelegate trying to give up my role as a superdelegate institutionally, I think that the strongest candidates for president in 2020 are going to be the people who helped elect Democrats in 2017 and 2018.
All right. And really quickly, we've got about 30 seconds left. Marisa or Katie, you want to jump in on that question?
I've just been thinking about how I actually think that a sort of messy fight involving a lot of candidates might be good for Democrats. I think there was a sense of inevitability with Clinton that turned a lot of people off. And I think that having a broad field and a real primary, instead of being a bad thing, I think could actually be beneficial.
Voters want to be heard and they want authenticity.
All right. Katie Merrill, that is the last word this hour. She's a partner in Baumann Merrill, political consultant here in the Bay Area. Marisa Lagos from KQED and Christine Pelosi, chair of the California Democratic Party Women's Caucus. Thank you all very much. To be continued, no doubt. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, Judy Campbell, Susan Britton, and Jeremy Siegel. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer today is Katie McMurrin. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Anna Sterla and Patrick Fitzgerald. Our managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. And our executive producer is Holly Kernan. For Michael Krasny, I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.